Okay. So today's date is the 17th of January, 2011, and my name is Bridget Brownlow, and I'm here with Heather Harris commencing an interview at approximately 10:10 a.m. So Heather, could you please state your full name?
Heather Jean Harris.
And your date and place of birth?
December 19th, 1942, Halifax.
And could you describe your educational background?
High school QEH, went into Dalhousie in pre-med. I have no mind for science at all, but it sounded good. And then went and worked, and then started chipping away with night courses at St. Mary's, simply because Dalhousie didn't offer them.
What years was that you were night courses?
Probably 65, 66, 67, somewhere in there. And the night courses, I would have had some courses from Dalhousie, so that all filtered in. And I was working at, I think, Imperial Oil, and they had a deal where they would supplement if you went back to university if you were taking courses, which I'd forgotten about. So that was, you know, that was a nice arrangement. Anyway, my vivid memory, I took from Joanne Nugent, who died probably last year, and her, let me see, her nephew is now a prof here, Mark, is it Mark Bobian or Louis Bobian? Mark, I think, Bobian.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, Mark Bobian's mm-hmm. here. So his aunt would have been Joanne. So Joanne was probably one of the first women principals in Halifax. And she was teaching literature. And it was interesting what the component parts there were, because it was a lot of teachers who would be upgrading their licenses.
In these evening courses.
Yeah. Right. So what interests me there, Bridget, because you know this is more what I'm in for this morning, is to really go through what the times were like there. So you have Dalhousie saying that the only courses you could get would be if you went right after, like at 4 o'clock or 4:30. So St. Mary's somehow had moved into the niche thing of the evening courses. And in those evening courses were significant women.
Okay.
Yeah. Which to me then is probably why I don't know when the BED program started at St. Mary's, but when women would have come in, you would have had an audience who were already user-friendly to hear, and who found the Mount. The Mount was referred to as Hungry Hill.
Hungry Hill?
Hungry Hill.
Why?
Because it was women and the men were at St. Mary's.
And then the perception was that the women were hungry to meet the men? Isn't that hilarious?
Yeah.
Hungry Hill.
Hungry Hill.
I haven't heard that before.
Well, I hadn't. I've forgotten that. That's why I say this is, to my mind, I'm just going the routes that it went in. So it seems to me Jeannie Larson was Mount.
Yes, she
was. And Jeannie would also have a, she did Homecoming 73 with me. Al Keith and Terry Donahue and I shared Homecoming 73. And 74, it was just hilarious. Terry was junior partner in my uncle Bruce's law firm, and I was working here in 72 to 73, which added yet another dimension to my experience here. And I lived in high rise too. And any of us from that era refer to them as whatever they are. We refer to them as high rise one and high rise two. And I lived on the 12th floor. And David and Elizabeth Chard were on that floor as well. And Mike Quinn, who was on the hockey team, was across, and his wife and his then young daughter. And we'd all be trying to get dressed and out the door at the same time. So anybody whose buttons weren't undone, everybody went down the hall fastening everybody else up. It was just it was a hoot and a holler. Anyway, so to me, there would have been people who would have wanted to do degrees at St. Mary's who were of the female persuasion. 65, I was taking American History, 1965 to the present being 1965, and in walks Mrs. Chard. I say Mrs. Chard because David Fleming, who was the grand organizer of materials for the St. Mary's High School alumni, would have had her when she first came, okay, when she was Miss Hutton. So when I was a founding member of the St. Mary's Board Hall of Fame, and I got David on because I'm a past president of the national organization, which is the Canadian Association for Sport Heritage. I wanted him on because at the national level, we're really big on conservation and on CCI, the Canadian Conservation Institute, and PARIS, the Pictorial Artifact Retrieval Information Systems. So that I wanted somebody on who could talk with authority on those areas, and David came on, and he ended up as chairing, probably was the second chair, Ann Musset was the first one, and he would be here, and Elizabeth usually sat at the opposite end of the Sport Hall of Fame committees. I would sit in the middle, then the conversation would go on, and then I'd look at David and I'd say, gee, it sounds like there's a significant gap there. And he said, exactly, I would say it's a significant gap. And back and forth we'd go on significant gap. And then Elizabeth would start hooting because that was her signature phrase, you know.
Right.
Well, we have a significant gap here, and we had both taken history from her. So what's neat about St. Mary's is that family kind of thing,
yes,
I feel has gone right through from when I was here, and Ken Osmond, Ken and Betty really worked at that, and Colin Carroll the same. So even though the university is much bigger physically and everything like that, it still has that one where you can come in and talk to the director of student services without all the probably great respect, etc., the chief poobah deserves. Anyway, back to then, she walked in and she had on a black, she had on what is properly called Oxford stuff. She was incredible, so that was fine. So anyway, what happened to me was I had an opportunity to go full time, and so what I did was I would have come in on 68, 69, 69, 70, so I would have gotten that first degree, that BA, or 70.
So you were in with the first group of full-time women.
Yeah.
Which was the fall of 68.
Yeah, yes. But the way that happens, again, as I mentioned, John Broom, when he was with the Alumni Association, asked me all about these firsts, and I said, you have to be very specific about what first you're talking about.
Yes.
If you're talking about the first women or the first woman, you're going to, Mike Larson is going to say Jocelyn Grasby.
Yes.
Okay, but there are others who would say Eileen O'Leary Carroll, and please do interview her. She's very articulate, and she, her story is an interesting one, and she was an MP in Ontario for Paul Martin's.
She's living here in Halifax?
No, she would live in Ontario for Paul Martin's. She was, and her area that she was really concerned with was Darfur. So she would have been, she would have had a posting in Paul Martin's.
Wow.
Yeah, and she's an interesting person. So each of them would be the first in a particular instance.
But they were both in the evening?
No.
Were they?
No, they were daytime people. And so they were the, like when you're talking about first women, there would be Jocelyn, who I think was doing science, I have no idea, and Eileen O'Leary, I'm not sure what she was doing, but they are technically the first. Were they at exactly the same time? I don't even think they were. I think there would have been perhaps a year in the difference or something. And I think one was in science. I think Jocelyn Grasby, Mike would remember. And Eileen, if you ask Mike about Eileen O'Leary Carroll and Jeannie, they would probably be able to orient her you more quickly than I can, but the end part of it is when we did the reunion, she very much, you know, sent messages and all that kind of stuff. and kept in touch with Elizabeth, or Elizabeth was really good at keeping in touch with everybody. So, but the first actually group would have been that 1968 crew, but the defining of the bells would have been those in and out. For instance, Chris Parker Butler would have been, and Mary Evelyn Turnan, her dad was the registrar. What was Jim Turnan? Could have been student services, I don't know. Or was that Leo McDonald? Don't know. Anyway, Mary Evelyn Turnan's father was Jim Turnan, and it was either like student services or stuff. It would have been all over in the main building, Loyola. And that crew, the crew that came in various parts, so that you would have people who came in 68 who probably graduated in 69 or 70. So I would have done that BA in 70. So we were all in that, and then you would have people who came in 68 who graduated in 72, mm-hmm. whatever like that. So you've got various firsts, and mm-hmm. I think that's really important to understand. But the crew who are thought of as the bells, the first 50 or whatever it is, I always thought it was around 50, and I don't know what the student population was. I just remember that all the guys were very happy to have us in the classes.
No, yes, I wanted to ask you about that. So prior to that, I mean, you'd been already, you know, assimilated to some degree because you'd been taking night courses.
Yeah.
So what
But not really, because the day students didn't really take night courses, not too many. They probably, even with something like English 100 or that level of, they probably even at that time were offering it in the day and in the night, and I'm not sure. And of course, who would know is gone, which is Kevin Cleary. Kevin, I remember, was registrar, and what was neat about Kevin Cleary was he knew everybody's name, and so that if you were not around for, you know, a little while, you could get a call saying, how are you doing, anything, mm-hmm. I can do that kind of thing. So
did you have any apprehension about being amongst this first group?
Absolutely not. I mean, the big thing to me was that I was able to go right in, you know, that I didn't have to go to the Mount, mm-hmm. and that the everything, it was great. I love adventures.
And why would your preference have been St. Mary's?
Because when I was chipping away at it, they were there.
Right, okay.
That was quite, I'm very loyal on that kind of thing.
Right.
If you prick the blood, it comes out maroon and white. and that was it. You know, to me, you got the attention. It was all to do with, I can actually remember going to Dow and the registrar's office to enroll in an after work. And it was very much, you know, if you don't do that kind of thing, you can come to a 4 o'clock class or a 5 o'clock class, but we don't want to. And then I phoned St. Mary's and it was, yeah, you know, come on down and see what we can do. So mm-hmm. So my experience was, okay, I'm big on little engines that can.
Yes.
And so St. Mary's had that. And so to me, that wasn't a factor of anything except that they were there. Accommodation, mm-hmm. exactly. And of course, it was great when the classes started and everything like that. There was no, I think people, Jen is going to be interesting to talk to because she was in engineering, so I have no idea what her experience was. Anne McGilvery and I were on the alumni executive at the same time. I think Mary Ann Hotchkiss might have been the first female ever to be on the alumni executive.
Now, can I ask about, was there any religious consideration in terms of your attending St. Mary's or not?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not Roman Catholic.
So there was there anything that was related to the, you know?
You had to have a philosophy course, and I had gotten that at Dow,
okay.
So that wasn't any kind of anything. But no, I was, at that time, I think, I became very friendly with Father Hennessy. He was just a sweetheart. I enjoyed the Jesuits because the Jesuits' big thing is education and really driven in that direction. And I think St. Mary's standards for academics, I think, were actually so ingrained, because I think the Jesuits, it's like 15 years of training.
Yes.
So they were, like, this was a really neat bunch. In the night courses, I did, would have done Joanne Nugent's in English. I would have done Elizabeth's in history. But I also took a course from in art history from Father Zacco. And Father Zacco and Father Burke Gaffney, I think, were experts on floral whatever and depicting. But anyway, Father Zacco, I can remember, and this course influenced me so much because I've done a lot of volunteer stuff with the Art Gallery of Nova Scotia, and my own interest in art would have stemmed from that. It was absolutely incredible. He taught us, I remember he was art history, so we did Jan Van Eyck's The Marriage Contract, in which it's the husband and the wife, and there's a terrier at the feet. It hangs in the National Gallery in London. When I went to England many years later, I went to the National Gallery and I just asked where that picture hung. And they said, oh, well, you can take a tour, whatever. I said, I only want to see that. And I went right to that and I sat on the bench in front of it and I looked at it. I knew the terrier. I knew that Van Eyck had painted himself in the mirror on the Stations of the Cross. And I looked at that and I knew I was an educated person.
Yes.
And that went right back to Father Zacco. At that time, there was a famous painting, probably the Vatican or something, of Christ, whatever. And he had little copies of it and he handed them around and he asked, he said, you know, if anybody is not a Roman Catholic, I will give it to you if you wish to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that because I thought, oh, isn't that interesting? And probably wouldn't have happened if it was not, but he was so conscious. He was a priest, of course, and he was really conscious of that, that the people who were in his class may not all be Roman Catholic.
Right.
So I'm
very considerate.
Oh, I thought it was.
So that would you have known of any others who were not Roman Catholic within
It was never anything. I grew up in Halifax. Your neighbors were Jewish, Roman Catholic. I mean, to me, it was just another neighborhood.
Okay.
That's the way it's always been for me. You know, I've been really, really fortunate. I roll around. A third of our family is Jewish, but that didn't happen until much later after St. Mary's. It's just my great fortune to have been brought up in a home in which... Halifax is very small.
Right, yes,
I don't know where you grew up.
Yes, here in Halifax.
Yeah,
well,
then that was it. It had to do whether you were a good person and good in your faith. What your faith was didn't much as matter, you know.
Right, right.
So no, there was never any anything along that line. Still isn't. I always go to, if I'm in town, I will always go to the Mass at Homecoming, which they brought back, which I thought was great. And I have always gone to, you know, if whatever my favorite spot for quiet time, if I'm downtown working on anything, is to pop into the Basilica.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to the Cathedral. And to First Baptist. Mm-hmm. And I always pass by the synagogue on my way to First Baptist. Just make sure everything's
covered.
You've got
all bases covered.
All bases covered. All bases. So the only significant group in my education, because everybody that was Jewish went to QEH.
Right,
so
right.
So I would have gone to QEH.
Right.
So therefore, I'm covered on that. So the only significant was Roman Catholic. So in one fell swoop, coming to St. Mary's would do it. So that kind of thing. So in the daytime, nothing interested me except, and I think people were looking for, I know Ann said in her area when she was doing commerce, and of course she would have been, maybe she was the only one, or maybe two.
Mm-hmm.
I would be the only one, sociology, I think I was the only one.
You're the only female?
I think so.
What was that like?
But the teacher was Jenny Tarlow. So she, I mean, it was nothing to me. I didn't think that way. My cousins were, except for one, all male. I mean, it didn't, what was interested me was the course and who was teaching it and stuff like that. And I did my master's with six guys. And the only thing I thought about that was, it was great. One of them was the captain of the football, the hockey team, Brian O'Byrne. And another one was the captain of the basketball team, Dennis Reardon. And they thought it was great, and I thought it was great. They were all tall and big, and we used to just walk down there. And, of course, I'm tottering at 147.5 centimeters and looking Dennis intently in the kneecaps. And Chard was the chair of the history department, mm-hmm. Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. So that... who else in there? I did get a couple of, I'm trying to think of anything that would have been, I don't rattle too easy or it would have, I wouldn't have paid much attention to it. I think in, when I was taking, there was a Jesuit teaching the French 101, and there were just a few of us. Don Harper was a classmate in there, and it always bothers me. I always tell him, I say, you know, it always bothers me that you don't remember me and I remember you, because Father Divine always called the roll. And of course, you have H-A-R and H-A-R. And
right.
He just didn't remember me, and I always remembered him. So I tell him that every time I see him. So what it was that... I don't know if it was just his manner of teaching or what, but we had to write a French exam to see where we were on the whatever like that. And Father Divine announced the results, and he said to me, you know, you failed it so badly that you don't even hit the scale. And I thought, but that might have been just his teaching style. Mm-hmm. So I mm-hmm. certainly wouldn't have thought that was because I was a female. And he thought, the reason I think that he didn't think that way was he sent us to an institution. She was called Millie Harrington. Millie Harrington did remedial work in, probably they taught Latin, could have been whatever, Latin, French, and math. And we got in there, and she was an institution. You would come across her. We always made sure. She died many years ago. But anyway, Millie said to us, all of us that were doing remedial French, bottom line is, I don't speak French, and I don't know French. But you are going to know. I went from zero, below zero, to 92 by Christmas.
Excellent.
She used to throw chalk at us, and God help you, fear of God, she was typical of the stereotype teacher that you would have had in elementary school that you wouldn't have breathed until you got out of their class. But I didn't hit any, I didn't either hit it, or I had been in the workforce too long that I was in an area that it didn't matter. I thought it was great. Like I said, it was always, I was living off campus too, which I think would be a lot different than if you were living in residence.
Right. Okay.
You know, because yes. The residence experience would have been a redefining of how living arrangements were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know. But when I lived at St. Mary's that year, 72-73, I would have been on the 12th floor, and it was great. Good view of the football field,
mm-hmm.
all that stuff. And Clarkie, Ken Clark, and Keith were, the jobs around campus were campus police. And also you would be on the desk at High Rise too.
Mm-hmm.
And Keith would have been on the desk at High Rise too.
Okay.
And Ken Clark. So these guys got to be your buddies, which
sure.
they wouldn't have in another instance. So, and then in 72-73, I worked for Dr. Kerrigan. I had Bonnie's job for Dr. Kerrigan, and again that brought me in very close proximity with everybody. So for me there wasn't any of that kind of experience. I was geared totally to the education end of it and the you know, I went on to work with these people, and Keith went to work with St. Mary's right after he graduated.
Right. Yeah. Can you recall any thoughts or feelings of, you know, a discriminatory nature?
None.
By any of your female friends at the time?
No.
No, okay.
No, there was none of that. But again, I think that you've got somebody who's grown up here, who's been, who was working and came at it a different way.
Yes.
So I found out, I think anybody who was at any other institution of a female persuasion at that time certainly would have thought it was great to be one or 50 of several hundred in which the rest were all male.
Right, okay.
Everybody looked at it. We
was
just
it?
Say,
yes.
Oh, of course, eat your heart out.
Yeah.
That was it. So it was nothing. And we knew, as far as the guys go, everybody knew they were in seventh heaven. I mean, here they had been at this all-male
mm-hmm.
school, etc., at a very hormonal age.
That's right.
So, no. And no. As far as the Jesuits go, I think the Jesuits, because their goal is education, I saw them more as teachers, and that was a big difference between St. Mary's and Dalhousie, and still is in some ways, is that Dal was so research oriented that the professors there were often thought of to be that they had to take a teaching load in order to get their research grants.
Right. Okay.
Where St. Mary's was always a teaching, the Paul Cormiers, that kind of person, David Hope, these people were teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very much apparent to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that, at that time, that
mm-hmm.
certainly was. And I think that's why St. Mary's, when the ducks were all in place, why it was able to take off. It's a very short history. I mean, within a very short time that integration took place, and I don't ever recall any kind of, you know, things people were concerned with is we needed a common room, we needed washrooms.
Right.
It was practical
right.
stuff
yes.
like that. Where were
okay.
we going to go?
Right, right.
Like, all the hangouts were already established, so there weren't unisex bathrooms in that, and so that was one of the first things Elizabeth did was find us a, we used to call it the room for common women, as opposed to a common women's room.
And where was that on campus?
Don't ask me. I think we were on the, it would have had to have been in the main building, probably on the second floor or something like that. When I first went there, when I was taking night courses, the library was on the top floor of the McNally building, and very nice staff, but when you walked in, there was a creak so that, you know, your presence was always announced. So and then of course things moved around, and I actually it was great because when I was doing the Ken Osmond I went to when we wanted to set up a sport hall of fame, and I said, how do you want this to come to you? And he said, it would really help if there was a historical justification. And I said, once a prof, always a prof, because he taught at UPEI, so I went through right the earliest written history we have, which is late 1800s, early 1900s, it starts to really come. And as I went through that, I would hit all these people, like Dr. Dalton, who, when he was a student here and that, so I hit him as my political science prof, which was neat. He was one of the four, and Peter O'Coyne, who went on to a distinguished career nationally and internationally, and who else? Ed McBride, Bucky McBride. Ed McBride he had a White House connection, so he was the one that he had either worked in the White House when Kennedy was there, or he had that Kennedy connection. And so Bob Bazon was the other one, and I met Bob Bazon the first time in years at the Sobeys Lacewood, which is like Grand Central Station. Anyway, what I used to do Ed McBride was just a superb teacher, and he'd say, you see, you understand, and his word was stratartical. So I always remember the key word, stratartical.
How do you spell that?
I have not a clue, because spelling's not my thing. I spell by sound, so Catholic was C-A-T-L-I-C-K. So anyway, with Ed McBride, Peter O'Coin and Bob Bazon said, you will go to any means, won't you? Because what I did was I had every major book published on Kennedy at that particular time tucked under the arm with titles facing out, including White House Nanny by Maud Shaw. And I would parade around with those. And I told this to Ed McBride years later, and I said, you know, those guys just thought I was, that I got it because, you know, I had it stacked. He said, no, it was absolute brains. He's just, and he has been in ill health for the last couple of years, and that team of everybody that he would have taught,
yes,
are just a great support team. He lost his wife a couple of years ago, Marianne. She was probably, Elizabeth said, the best history student that she ever had, and Marianne
wow.
taught there. So what it is like cross-generational,
yes.
whatever. So that sense of family and
yes.
sense of association, you know. Mary's son, Dr. Mary's
yes.
son, Mary taught me Asian studies, and she taught Keith as well.
Yes.
And so that, I remember when Keith and Marianne got married, I was in Vancouver teaching, and I sent a telegram because I used to drive me up the wall. You were supposed to say Hung Chu, and I'd say Hang Chow. So I signed my telegram Hang Chow Heather. So Keith, I would have known from the desk,
yes,
and from Asian studies, you know. So she was. See, what was so neat, Bridget? It was the takeoff point. That's why I say with the prehistory, what leading up to this, that all the ducks were on the pond, and to me, the bells that women came in was just that. To me, the guy that's publishing the sport history book that we're doing at the Sport Hall of Fame, Frank something or other, see, he sees that this is the big defining thing, and in sport, in a way, it was. Kathy was the first woman, whatever. But the ducks were lined up in so many areas that to me, I saw this as one, but the secular presidencies, you know,
yes.
that
yeah.
so that you have a whole lot, and so that when you're doing your dissertation, to me, it's really important to get those other threads
yes,
in,
of course.
So you can see, I think, that everything
yes.
fed off everything else.
There was a great deal of angst. Now, you might not have been aware of this, given your situation, but there was a great deal of angst from the Mount's perspective.
Oh,
yes.
You can imagine. Absolutely.
Can you help me understand anything that you would have remembered about that?
Oh, certainly. There would be, because in the town, entrenched in the town, as leaders in education, would have been the Sisters of Charity.
Mm-hmm.
And more power to them.
Mm.
I took music from age 4 at St. Teresa Convent on Corner North and Oxford, and that was St. Teresa's Convent. So I actually ended up, when I was in high school, the Mount Limousine used to pick me up at 1 o'clock on Fridays, because we had Friday afternoons off at QEH, and take me out to the Mount, and I would, I continued on with my music teacher, because I did a lot in Halifax musical festivals and all that kind of stuff. So I would have gone out there for my music lesson, and then I would have come back on some blue bus, whatever like that. But Father Hennessy used to say, oh, he'd say out there, he'd say, you know, feed them 3 bowls of rice a day, they're all set. But the Jesuits,
what does that mean?
Well, he just felt that, you know, you could keep them so cheap. And see, all of those, there was a separate school system.
Yes, yes.
So with the separate school system, of course, you had a crew of extremely highly educated, because they would have, Father Hennessy would again say, what else did they have to do except add on degrees?
Right. Of the Sisters of Charity.
Absolutely.
Right.
So you have a highly contingent. The thing that I laugh at with Brian Downey is, his father was chair of the board and everything like that, and law associate of my office and all that. But anyway, Brian and I laughed both. Is it Gate of Heaven Cemetery? That's so Gate of Heaven Cemetery. So Brian always says, I'm Halifax boy, I don't want to be buried out there. But I said to Brian, you know that place, I said, if you go out and go through it, the headstones for the sisters and for the priests, and to me, the Sisters of Charity, I mean, unbelievable. The separate school system here, I think that benefited greatly in a particular, history is the science of people and time. That's Marc Bloch, who's my favorite historian. He was gunned down as a French resistance Jewish person in the Second World War. Anyway, they're phenomenal, the Halifax Infirmary. I see, I was born at the infirmary, and in those days, most people who were of Protestant parentage would have been born at the Grace Maternity.
Oh, interesting.
But I was born at the Halifax Infirmary, which was the Catholic. Everything around here was always done in such a way that, I know my cousin-in-law, she just couldn't believe it, the alternating between a Catholic and a Protestant lieutenant governor.
Right, right.
The
yes.
heads of the fire department, all the major jobs, police, yeah. they were all done that way.
I forgot about
it,
that.
Well, that's why I'm saying my chief reason for being here with you this morning is the social context, because I think that's really important, so that you have a whole, you have not only St. Mary's with the St. Mary's with the 50, the first 50, was really a small part of a whole community mm-hmm. that was at a takeoff point, and that's what I think is exciting. Mm-hmm. St. Mary's and the whole, but that's how it worked.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I can remember having Christmas dinner, and my cousin-in-law was there, and this was when they were just courting, she and my cousin, and you know, she said, oh, how quaint, and he said, you know, it's puffing on the cigar at that time, and he just said, well, it works for us, and it did for a long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So some of it you didn't get riled about, because that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think also in with Nova Scotia, and I lived in BC for many years, so I certainly have a good comparison there, and I think some of it has to do with just where you are. We don't tend to sensationalize stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I did a book with my sport history writing partner, Sandy Young, on Maritime Sports Stars on Parade. It was on my uncle, Alec Nickerson, who was an editor of the Chronicle Herald for quite some time, and Bob Chambers, who was his really good friend, who was the Bruce McKinnon, and Bob Chambers was Bruce McKinnon's hero. He was the predecessor, he did the cartoon. And he would have been when Robert Stanfield was living at the Oaks, okay? So I remember when we interviewed Mr. Chambers, he said, you know how we worked in our town? He said, because I would be coming from my home, and I would often meet Bob Stanfield coming up from the Oaks, because everybody walked to work. And he said, you know, how you did cartooning in that those days, where you made your point, and his are classics. I have an original, which is quite exciting to have. But that would not be the tone of the town to lambaste or whatever. If people took their own life, or if there was a family that, if there was something that would affect the family of the reputation of the family, and these were, you know, hardworking people, it wouldn't appear as a sensational, this is the story, breaking news, etc., etc. It was the tone of the time, and so all of that, and none of it changed abruptly.
Mm-hmm.
It all seemed to me to be, and I think that's part of the Nova Scotia character. We're not into sensationalism
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
way. So we define stuff within our own experience.
Mm-hmm. So, along the lines of the secularization of St. Mary's, in the journals during that time, there is virtually nothing So there, from what I could tell in my research,
This is why
it was virtually not discussed, not the way coeducation was. I mean, the journals were filled with articles on coeducation, both positive, both pro and con, you know. Why would you, can you give me some insight into that in terms of what you noticed or didn't notice, maybe, about university becoming a secular institution?
Well, I would have been, it would have been, what were the dates? I can remember.
1970.
Yeah, I can remember Father LaBelle, but you see, here again, it's really important to look at who the major characters were. So Edmund Morris would have been interim when? He's on one of my degrees.
Yes, 1970.
So, yeah. And then Kerrigan came in.
After that, 71, 72.
So here you have a person in Edmund Morris, devout Roman Catholic, absolutely devout. His son is the priest at St. Mary's Basilica. He's got his father's gifts for gab. Always say about Edmund, never say in 500 words what you can say in 5,000. He was just a wee, and that's the way he spoke, and that's why I'll often say to somebody, if you knew Edmund Morris, sometimes if I get on a story, I'll say, I'm doing an Edmund Morris. What you had in Edmund Morris was an experienced politician.
Yes.
Okay, who was vastly networked. So to me, the smooth transition came because he was a Roman Catholic, therefore sensitive. You couldn't have had a, there was not an abrupt there, because it was a person of the community, extremely well networked, devout Roman Catholic, but politically astute. And that's how my observation would do it. And I can remember when Alan Terry and I were, what was Edmund's term again? It was to 1970 to 71, 73.
Yes, it was fairly brief.
70,
period of time.
Yeah, but it was brief enough that in when we were planning homecoming 73, he then, I think, went into a special something or other at the university, because I can remember Terry and Al and I sitting in the, where were we? The cafeteria, which would have been over in, over yonder, and we were looking at, we wanted we were having these people come. And so he said, well, what do you think? And I said, a barbecue pit. We need to be able to barbecue. And I remember we hired Billy Robinson, who was, who, you know, everybody was looking for jobs. And he said, you know, he said, I was thinking that. He said, you know, as we move towards, and here was another move, Bridget, towards establishing those residences as paying, in other words, conferences, to have conferences, okay?
Yep.
So Edmund said, you know, really for conventions and that. I was thinking the other day, and I was sort of looking over in that direction, and I was sort of thinking what we really need is a barbecue pit. And Al and Terry and I said, oh, we were just to say, he said, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up. And the next thing I knew, we had the barbecue pit.
Yes.
And it was great. So I think that, I think the great gods were were smiling down, because I think, of course, being a historian, I certainly went through all the stuff where the McNabs had to buy seats in St. Paul's in order to do business when Halifax was first founded.
Right, right.
So you have an interesting thing here where we're Catholics. I'm a member of the Charitable Irish. I don't know how Irish I am, but I'm hoping I'm charitable. Keith is too. And anyway, so I certainly historically was well aware of where the Roman Catholic would be. But I also am very well aware of how the, in the town there would be what was called Lace Curtain Irish, which would have been Terry's family, would have been Lace Curtain Irish. But it was Lynn's family, the Cosgroves, who were actually first cousins to Mary McAleese, the president of Ireland. So when she was given her honorary doctorate, she referred to her cousins in the front row, and I said, you're just along for the ride, Terence Arbeedy. And he said, I know it. So that the relation, the key to the whole how things happened to me has to do with how we were to one another people, as people in this community. And I'm not saying that there wasn't this, that, or the other thing there, but how we handled it would have been different than other communities.
Yes.
In that everybody, I often refer to it as being Japanese, because Japanese put a great effort towards saving face, so
yes,
that everybody has a polite, a politesse,
yes,
they would say down in St. Anne's, a politesse, and that's what was here. So again, to me, there wouldn't, if you were picking, identifying a person to do the transitional role, that would have been it.
He would have been key. Fascinating.
Absolutely. How that came about, I have no idea.
Okay.
I have no idea. But you can see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Prominent,
mm,
well connected, mm, but also very well known for his, mm-hmm, for his faith.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Can I jump back for a minute to the level of awareness that you would have felt at the time about, again, about the Mount's alarm at St. Mary's becoming coeducational? There would have been a lot in my research in the local paper,
mm-hmm,
as well as,
oh,
here in the journal,
shake,
in the Mounts.
Shake, rattle, roll. I just thought, yes, it was, I thought it was a hoot. I thought, okay, gang, you're going to have to, which they did, because they immediately then started specializing in,
yes,
in courses for women or whatever along that line. But really, I think, I have no idea when you talk to anybody else, but I thought it was, you know, I just thought it was great. And as far as the Mount went, I was, as I say, I had gone there to music. I'm a huge admirer of the, what the other thing that was happening along the line there too, Bridget, was the fact that they were defrocked. So I remember distinctly a Sister Blanche, and anybody that I know that went there at that time remembers her. And she was a great big gal with a huge cross, so she would be coming down that corridor with that swinging. And you know, when Sister Blanche and the crew went into civvies, that removed a lot of the mystique and the, yeah, so you have that.
So
that
the Vatican
happening.
The Vatican II changes.
Absolutely.
Were happening. Right, right.
So physically you have people who wore, I mean, priests just had their collars, like ministers, etc., etc. Although Father Zacco and Father Bert Gaffney, who was a sweetheart, they would have a black suit on and that. But the ladies had the swinging gowns.
Yes,
they had,
yes,
the full gowns and
the headgear.
Oh,
mm,
yes. Who was it? Sally Field, Flying Nun. You know,
mm,
I mean, you're there with that whole habit on.
Mm-hmm.
That could shake, rattle, and roll anybody. So therefore, at that time, probably, or somewhere around there, they would have moved into civvy habits. And it doesn't matter when it happened. It's always interesting to me historically. But if you're getting this place set up to have women come in, and you also are making such an extreme change in the habit that you wore, which was to me very, I mean, you were established as a presence, you just swished in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that would be another factor, which, as I say, is again what my target was this morning, and we'll reconnect again, because I'm really this morning coming to you less as a bell and more as a historian, and as what factors were in the community.
Yes, I'm very grateful for that, for your, you know, the comprehensive nature of
I
your
I just think
overview.
There were a bunch of things, so that,
yeah,
I think sometimes people tend to take something that is significant, which was the admission of women here, but not see it in the context of the times.
The historiography
so to
around
me,
it, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So to me, you know, it was an exciting time because so much was happening.
Yes, yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, at induction in the fall, you know, I said to Colin, this is really neat. You know, you're sitting here in front of me, because I always suggest to him, and Keith was speaking this year because students are, athletics is now under student services for a bit. And so I'm there, you know, this is a point that should be made. And they're laughing, but I said to Colin, you know, it's so neat. There's, you know, Owen's standing there and Ken's standing there, and
yes,
it's the family, yes, the cross generational. And I bumped into Florence and Owen in the shopping center a week later, and you know, he just said the same thing. It's still so neat. He's really interesting. Did you talk to him live?
No, not yet.
Well, you want to talk to him?
Yeah.
He is really interesting because he has achieved.
He wasn't here during the specific time frame.
No, but he's the one that. But again, you know, one of the things that happened outside of there was he was the one that really pushed for the co-educational athletic program, and that's really, really, really important. And why he is interesting is because you don't always have somebody that's been successful at a job, and he would have been the first secular president, and then goes into the history department and has a highly successful teaching career and writing career. So he's an interesting person.
Well, that's wonderful. That's a wonderful piece of information that I wasn't aware of. So the
all
co-educational
kinds,
nature of the educational.
That's course. Why I don't know who it was directed to me in the president's. But as I said to Keith, he said, why are you here? He said, superintendent. And he said, how did that come about? I said, funny. I said, she said, at the president's office. So I said, the Lord works in mysterious
yes.
ways and wonders to perform. Colin would say, Bridget, just press her on button.
No, this is wonderful. Okay. Well, we've come
is
somewhat
it 11
to,
o'clock?
Yeah, it's 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
So I've sort of come to the end of the time frame for this particular interview, but I would like to review.
Yeah.
What we've discussed, and then meet with you again
yes.
if you're open to that. Too.
I am very open to it, because what I want out of it is eventually when you come up with the names of those first 50, that'd
yes.
be kind of
yes.
that'd be kind of neat. So the things I want to mention to you, what I brought in here. Okay, so the list that's with Heather is actually the only list that's left from. Then we would have had two reunions, and Elizabeth said she put that stuff over in the archives with Hansel.
Okay. Yes, I've seen his file. He has a file. I did go
fat
to see.
Not fat. No,
not
I don't think
fat.
It
no.
is. So
no.
I think what she thinks she sent over there and what actually made there were. I'm big on tracing that stuff. So back in those days, the other outfit you want to track down is. Whatever it was for PR and whatever, they, I don't know when the Times started, but there was a nice little one called the Between Times.
Oh.
So you want to see, I had these gems, which I haunt people with. I don't know if you know Bill Robinson. See, there's Sparky and Bill. That's
right.
So you really want to look at these, because there'll be some little gem somewhere or other that's going to strike
right,
you.
Right, yes, yes.
And the Between Times I have, let me see. So that one is what? November 73. And there is a 74. So I went to UBC. And Kevin Cleary then became, what did he become? Something or other with the alumni, coordinator of alumni or whatever like that. So he paid bucks so I could go out and buy a typewriter. And then we had the first, I set up the Vancouver branch.
Wow.
And we had Terry Heenan, who was vice president of BC Tel at that time. And who else? Peter Oland was running. Olin's or Labatt's, whatever, was out there at that time, so he was there. So in the fall of 1973, UBC, I went to Cecil Green Park, and they said, oh, you're another alumni. They set it up free of charge, so we got Cecil Green Park, lovely, lovely lounge area in there. They did everything they could to facilitate that. And on December 8th, of that year, we would have been in the Irish pub in Gastown having the first ever, it's the only time it ever happened. Terry was the president of the Alumni Association. He was in Boston for their event there. December 8th was the patronal feast,
yes.
And that's when the alumni dinner was always held. And Halifax would have been having it in Vancouver.
Wow.
We were down in Gastown. So this is called the Between Times, and I have no idea whether or not any of that stuff ever made it over. There's Terrence RBD.
Wow.
Yeah, so those maroon and whites, did you get into those at
yes.
all?
Okay, yes,
you got
I
into
have.
The maroon and whites, so you would have all the stuff on that. Yeah, oh, this was great. And Bob Ricola when he had here. Yeah, that's 74. 73 homecoming. There's Millie Harrington. She's the one who used to pitch.
Wow.
She pitched the chalk, and man, you learned. But that was what they had in place to help us.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and there's Father Zacco, who was the gentle, gentle person who gave me that shot. And
was he Polish?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just a beautiful man and very, very bright.
And
there's
Brocious.
You know Murray Wilson?
Yes.
There's Murr.
Oh, gosh.
Murr was on my 73, 74
Oh, he was Hungarian.
Hungarian, was he? Okay.
Yeah, he was secondary teacher training in Budapest.
Yeah. So,
wow.
I don't know why I've ended up with three copies of that one, but that was when Bob Ricola, who's now a member of their Tennessee... Whatever. Who else have we got here? Richard Bishop? An interview I would have done on Terrence RBD. Oh, this is that shot in there? Wait now, let me see. No, it isn't. But there's Mike Larson and all those crews. There's Father Hennessy, Amois. You can have that one, because it looks like I've got three of them.
Look at you!
Yes,
oh,
look
you
at
look
me.
Sweet.
I did, I interviewed Terry, and I was the regular columnist for the Maroon and White. Oh, here's my interview of this must be, it's your move. Oh, the Alumni Association, there I am. There. Yeah.
Well,
so,
Heather, this is wonderful. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It was fun. And you can tell Keith, well, you know, the only problem with Heather is you have to do most of the talking. So make sure you say that to him. I just loved, I got him outside and I said, so no, it was just.
Oh no, you've just been fabulous. And you know, I'm grateful.
Well, the other thing you need to do is phone the president's office and say, thank you very much. I found that she was helpful away. Would you please tell the president?
I will.
Please tell the president that I found her helpful. Hard to get her talking.
Yeah.
This is really important.
I will
say
do that.
That.
I will.
Say hard to get her talking.
Yes.
He needs a lot every day too.
That's wonderful. Okay, so I'm going to conclude the recording of this interview at 5 past 11. So we've been interviewing for 1 hour.